From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Governor Charlie Baker was in Washington today testifying about what Massachusetts can teach the federal government about health care.
Massachusetts has achieved near universal coverage with the highest rate of individuals with health insurance in the nation. That's a story I'm sticking to, too.
And WBUR's Anthony Brooks talks with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Also today, for Michael A., prison was like Dante's Inferno. That's what he wrote to his cousin Danielle, a Harvard professor.
Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out.
But he didn't really.
Exactly. No, his life changed inexorably that day when he was 15 and he tried to take somebody's car with a gun.
One family's story about the American tragedy of mass incarceration. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's begin today in Washington, where Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker testified before the Senate Health Committee as part of a rare bipartisan effort to fix a part of the Affordable Care Act. Not repeal and replace it, but fix it. Among the issues, what Congress needs to do to prop up and stabilize the individual health care markets. Governor Baker said the answer begins by following Massachusetts' example of embracing the spirit of bipartisanship.
Bipartisan cooperation is essential to achieving quality, affordable health care coverage and stabilizing any market.
WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is our man in Washington today, and he joins us now. Hello, Mr. Brooks.
Hey, Meghna. Good to hear you.
It's good to have you. So remind us why Governor Baker was specifically in Washington and what he's trying to accomplish.
Right. Well, he's here with four other governors, Republicans and Democrats, to talk about a big challenge facing the Affordable Care Act right now, and that is the viability of the individual health care markets. They're doing okay in Massachusetts, but in some other parts of the country, they're not. And one of the reasons is that the Trump administration has threatened to stop paying so-called cost-sharing reimbursements, which are known as CSRs. And this is among the big reasons that markets in many rural states are beginning to collapse or at least shrink. For example, here's the committee chairman, Republican Senator Lamar Alexander, who says at the end of September last year, Blue Cross pulled out of the individual markets in Knoxville, Nashville, and Memphis, which he says affected everybody in those markets. Here's a bit of what he said.
Tennessee's insurance commissioner testified yesterday. She said our state's individual market is very near collapse. An insurer in Virginia announced it'll pull out of parts of the state for the 2018 plan year, leaving 62,000 Virginians facing the very real prospect of having zero options for insurance next year.
So, Meghna, that's the challenge, and it's a challenge that Baker and four other governors, Bill Haslam of Tennessee, Steve Bullock of Montana, John Hickenlooper of Colorado, and Gary Herbert of Utah were here to talk about.
So a mix, then, of Democrats and Republicans in terms of the governors there. So was there a consensus on what to do?
Yeah, on some of the big issues there were. For example, all four of these governors agreed that Congress needs to ensure that those cost-sharing reimbursements, those CSRs, continue. Without them, insurers are choosing to pull out of the market or to raise their rates dramatically. And that's even at risk of happening here in Massachusetts. Here's Charlie Baker talking about that.
The reason the CSRs are so important at this point in time is to create stability and a sense of consistency for people at a point in time when they are literally going to be purchasing coverage for the next year. If the CSRs aren't in place, they're going to have to reprice those products, and they're probably going to go up by somewhere around 20%.
And Baker said that would be a big jump, a big problem for families trying to plan their budgets. And of course, health insurance premiums are already way up for lots of people.
Yeah, okay. So how then did the committee respond to Baker? And what's the significance that he was there front and center in Washington on this particular issue?
Well, Republicans and Democrats on the committee welcomed Baker's suggestions. As you suggested at the top of the segment, this is a rare moment of bipartisanship on the health care issue, which comes after that long, painful effort by Republicans to repeal the ACA, which failed. So now comes an effort by Lamar Alexander and other moderate Republicans to do something to fix it. The fact that Baker is here shows that he's emerged somewhat as a leader on this issue. Senator Elizabeth Warren introduced him, reminded the panel that he was served as the state Secretary of Health and Human Services, as well as Secretary of Administration and Finance, and spent a decade as president and CEO of Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare. Add that to Massachusetts' long quest for universal health coverage, and he has a lot of relevant expertise. So that's why he was here.
Absolutely. Relevant and possibly unique amongst any governor in the country. Now, Anthony, you just mentioned that Elizabeth Warren, Senator Warren, introduced Charlie Baker today. You were actually able to sit down with her after the hearing. So tell us more about what Senator Warren said.
Yeah, so this was a bit of a coincidence in that I had scheduled this interview with Senator Warren for today a while back, but it ended up coinciding with the hearing today. So we can listen to a bit of the conversation now. I started off by asking her if she's hopeful, if the bipartisan effort now underway to fix part of the ACA rather than kill it will be successful. Here's what she said.
Well, I certainly hope so. We have people, Democrats and Republicans, who are coming together and saying we can make some fixes to the Affordable Care Act to help stabilize these markets. And, you know, I think Massachusetts is truly the exemplary state for everyone on this. We recognized that if we really wanted to get coverage for everyone and try to help bring down costs, the only way that was going to happen is you wrote the law and then you came back and you adjusted it and you made some changes and you tweaked this part and you pulled that part until you got it better and better and better. And today, basically, that's what Governor Baker was testifying about. Mm-hmm. He said, we have good, stable markets in Massachusetts. And here's the key, especially when you're talking to these folks in Washington. We do it in a way that has high-quality plans. We don't do it by saying, hey, it's a great market, only your insurance coverage isn't enough to cover you if you actually get sick.
The big news this week, President Trump's decision to end DACA, the program to help young immigrants who were brought into this country as kids illegally. Trump says now it's up to Congress to fix this problem. Will this provide the impetus for Congress to actually fix it?
I hope so. We have a bipartisan bill already on the floor, Democrats and Republicans, that would make the program for Dreamers permanent. And I hope that we can get it through both the Senate and the House. I want to be clear. I think that President Trump was morally wrong to say that we're going to throw 800,000 young people in this country out. That we're going to take students, we're going to take people who are working, people who want to serve this country, and throw them out of the only home most of them have ever known. And I've got colleagues here in the Senate on both sides, Democrats and Republicans, who say that's wrong. So the ball's been put in Congress's court. It's up to us to pass the DACA bill. And I want to be clear. I think we need to pass it right now, not 6 months from now, right now.
I want to ask you, sort of sticking with the response to what Trump did, if there's a defense of what he's did, it might be that he saw DACA as legally indefensible. And as we know, several states' attorney generals are suing, right? Okay, you're sort of shaking your head. But what's wrong with the idea that this is up to Congress to fix?
Well, I'm glad for Congress to fix this. Yeah. But the president didn't have to roll back protection. And let's be clear, if there's a challenge in the courts, then let the courts play that out. No court had forced him to roll back DACA. And then to say to all those whose anti-immigrant fears he has been stirring up for over a year now, I'm going to throw out a bunch of kids who weren't born in the United States. And I just think it's morally despicable.
I'd love to ask you a couple of big questions about where the Democrats sort of find themselves in this political moment. As you know, in the past 8 years, lots of lost seats, state house seats, governorships, congressional seats, the White House, the Senate. What happened to your party?
Well, What I care about is, what is my party going to do right now?
Yeah.
And that is, I think our party has to show two things. One, what are our values? And the second is, are we really willing to get out there and fight? And I think healthcare has given us the perfect chance to do that. Let's face it, in America right now, there is one party that said, you know, it's fine to knock 25 million people off their healthcare coverage, drive up costs for tens of millions more, so that you could produce tax breaks for a handful of millionaires and billionaires. There's another party, the Democratic Party, that says healthcare is a basic human right, and we will find a way to get coverage for all Americans and a way to help bring down the cost before it bankrupts millions of families across this country. I think that's a good starting point for us. It's about our values, and it's about hardworking people across this country who play by the rules and who just want a level playing field, just a chance to build some security. And I think healthcare is a good place to start that.
One more thing. I'm sure you saw this. In July, Mark Penn, former advisor to Bill and Hillary Clinton, wrote this in the New York Times. Candidates inspired by Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and a host of well-funded groups have embraced a sharply leftist agenda. But the results at the voting booth have been anything but positive. Democrats lost over 1,000 legislative seats across the country and control of both houses of Congress during the Obama years. So this is an argument for the moderate wing of the Democratic Party.
No, it's not.
Okay, tell me what it is.
Give me a break. I mean, really. Healthcare. We just did this. Healthcare isn't some, what did he call it? A leftist, come on.
Sharply leftist ideas.
Sharply leftist ideas. Healthcare, not knocking 25 million people off healthcare, reducing the costs of student loans that are crushing millions of people across this country, strengthening and expanding Social Security, building a strong infrastructure in this country. Those are the things we're out there fighting for. We're fighting for a chance for everybody to be part of a 21st century economy. That's the heart of what it means to be a Democrat.
All right. Well, Senator Warren, thank you so much for taking time to talk to me. Real pleasure.
Thank you. Good to
thank
see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Well, that's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks speaking with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Anthony is in Washington today. Interesting conversation there with the senator, Anthony, but I got to ask, did you ask her about a potential presidential run?
Well, so I sort of did and I didn't, because she always answers the same way. So this got cut out of the conversation, but this is what I said. I said, so I'm not going to ask you whether or not you're running for president because you always say the same thing. I'm focusing on my reelection campaign. She interrupted me and said, and the answer is no. So conversation went. And she gets asked that pretty much every time she sits down with people like me, and that answer is pretty much uniform, even though speculation abounds that she's preparing for a run in 2020.
Well, that's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's in Washington today, bringing us up to speed on what Governor Charlie Baker testified regarding health care before the Senate, and his conversation with Senator Elizabeth Warren. By the way, we're going to put the entirety of Anthony's conversation with Senator Warren on our website. That'll be at radioboston.org. Anthony, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure, as always, Magna.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to spend the rest of the hour having, I think, a really important, special conversation. It's with Danielle Allen. She's a Harvard professor and director of the university's Safra Center for Ethics. And I don't often say this, I've basically never said it, but I think Danielle Allen has written one of the most important books published in America in the past 5 years. It's called Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A., and it's the story of her beloved cousin, Michael. Danielle and Michael were very close, but while Danielle went to an Ivy League college and propelled herself into a fast-rising academic career, Michael was arrested for the first time when he was just 15 years old. he spent his teen and early adult years in prison, a 13-year sentence. And when he got out, he was never really free. He died violently in 2009 at the age of 29. Two cousins, whose lives were once on similar paths, diverged dramatically. But that fork in their road was put there by us, by American society, and a culture that in the 1990s believed young black boys were super predators. It amplified the war on drugs, imposed mandatory minimum sentences, locked up an entire generation, and threw away the key. So while this is Michael and Danielle's story, it is really our American story. And I believe we'd better listen. Because as Danielle Allen writes, Michael was just one of so many millions gone. So with all that, let me finally say to Danielle Allen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Meghna.
So I have to say, I don't really even know how to start, okay?
Okay.
And I will try not to be constantly overwhelmed by how important this is. So let's just start with, what was Michael like as a kid?
Oh, gosh. He was just such a joyful person, so bright, so energetic. He had this gorgeous smile. It's always the first thing everybody said about him, this gigantic smile that lit up half his face. And he was a motor mouth, incredibly talkative. He was just beloved. You know, he was sort of the baby of a huge extended family and just adored.
Yeah. And you were really close, right?
We were, yeah. So we had this big, huge network of cousins, but we were sort of a subset of cousins that spent a really big amount of time together.
Yeah, because the threads and the network and the relationship within your family is also a major part of this story. I mean, so tell me more about growing up. Like, when did your lives intersect, and when did your life and Michael's life sort of drift apart?
Sure. I mean, there is a way in which it's a big American story, because my dad and his sister Karen grew up on this tiny island off the coast of northern Florida, southern, you know, African-American fishing community. And my dad ended up in Claremont, California as a college professor. Karen ended up in Los Angeles as a single mother, having left an abusive relationship, and worked her way up as a nurse. But so we had I grew up as a faculty brat in a college town. Michael was growing up in the city, but they spent a lot of time with us. They lived with us sometimes. We always were gathered together on holidays, lots of the time playing outside in the summer and so forth. The real shock in Michael's life came when he was 10, his mother met somebody and thought she had the prospect of a happy life, a marriage, stability, and so forth. And it was just the most tragic decision. The person she married turned out to be violent. Mm-hmm. The family moved 5 times in 5 years. Michael was changing school constantly. And that was exactly the same time. So I was going off to Princeton. So you asked where our lives diverged. Like, that's sort of when they diverged, was when his life got caught up in this terrible marriage of his mother's, and I was headed off to liberal arts education in beautiful surroundings.
Yeah. You call him, like, he's little Michael. He's like your little brother. Mm-hmm. And in that difficult time, he's just a kid, right?
Exactly. I mean, so they were back in Southern California, and that was the years between 1992 and 1995 when everything was happening. I mean, they're basically the peak of violent crime in Southern California at that point in time. The issue of gangs and drug trafficking was on everybody's mind. At that point, Michael was this free-floating agent. He didn't have a community. He didn't have a world. And I think landed in the middle of an incredibly difficult, rough Los Angeles. And it's exactly when all the pieces of Michael's life sort of gave way.
If we could, I mean, because I think people need to know, can we talk about the circumstances of his arrest when he was 15?
Sure.
Right? Because he had a gun.
Yes. So it was a Sunday morning in September 1995, and Michael had a gun. He'd acquired it a couple of weeks earlier. We don't know exactly how. He came upon a guy, a 44-year-old guy, cleaning a Cadillac. And, you know, Michael came up, told him to hand over his watch. Guy did. Wallet. Guy did. It was empty. Michael threw it back and said, "I'm taking the car." And then his victim lunged for him. Michael had his gun pointed at the ground the entire time. That was one of the details that the victim told the police. So the victim lunged for the gun, got it, and shot Michael through the neck. And that was the end of his attempted carjacking. It turned out, so then, you know, the police came, ambulance came, they took Michael to the hospital, and on the way there, he both confessed to what he'd just done, but he also told the police that he had also robbed two people the previous day in the same block, and or three people, rather, and one person a week earlier in the same location. So there was this time, something was going on. It was a spree, you have to say that, about that week. It came out of nowhere. That is, there hadn't been anything like that in his experience before then, and it was over. And he had never been a violent person, so it was a very surprising episode.
But this is a moment in which context is so important here, right? Because as you analyze in the book, California had its three strikes law.
Right, which was brand new. I mean, that's right. It was like 18 months old. This was the big thing.
And there was extreme public attention and interest around carjacking in Southern California. I mean, it was just like a really terrible time. In that great sweep, he goes from not having a criminal record to facing potentially life in prison.
That's right. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's it.
Based on what happened on that one day.
Yes, that's exactly right. So the judge told him that, you know, he had to make a decision about his plea. Was he going to plead guilty or stand trial? And so what the judge said was, you know, if you stand trial and you're convicted on all four of these, that will trigger the no strikes law. And that'll be 25 years to life that you're facing in sentencing. So the framework of the three strikes law was working to frame conversations about plea deals, basically. So being presented with what looked like a sort of 25-year to life option on the one hand, since he'd already confessed to everything, or a plea deal, he took the plea deal.
Well, I mean, you write about how his mother, your aunt,
that's right,
prayed to find, to have an answer, which one to choose.
Yeah, Michael himself couldn't choose. He couldn't choose.
Well, 15-year-old could.
Yeah, so it was, and I think for my aunt, that was probably, you know, one of the most, if not the most painful moments in the whole experience. And she said, you know, she went outside the courtroom and prayed and prayed and prayed some more, is how she tells the story. You know, God told her Michael would get 7 years. So she went ahead and said that they should accept the plea deal. And instead, he got 13 years.
I'm going to ask you this question a couple of times in this conversation. How hard is it or was it for you to go back and go over all these details? Because, of course, not only was his life utterly transformed in that moment, but it reverberates through your entire family.
Everybody's. Yeah, no, it's true. It was hard. No question about it. But it was also good. As I said, we hadn't talked about what happened to Michael. We'd all been wrestling with that question separately. So this is this terrible thing that this kid, an adolescent, you know, dealing with all the ordinary torments of adolescence, was getting, you know, flirting with the most dangerous stuff in the city. And we didn't see it. And literally, I mean, it wasn't until I was working on this book, you know, sort of more than, you know, 20 years about, I guess, after he was arrested, is the first time that his mother realized he'd been getting involved in gangs. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I realized he'd been getting involved in gangs. And so that for me is one of the hardest, I don't know, most painful parts of it all, is just to sort of figure out, like, why is it that we didn't see? Why is it that adults don't see the kind of trouble that kids are getting into?
Well, I'm speaking with Danielle Allen. Her new book is Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. And Danielle, I just keep thinking about how all of this happened to Michael when he was 15. And by the time he's 17, he's sent to one of California's toughest adult prisons. But actually, it's there. It's there that we really hear from him. I guess what I mean to say is that in the book, we hear Michael's voice.
Yeah.
Because you include a lot of the writing that he did in prison.
He's very talented.
Extraordinarily talented.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I just read a couple of lines from one of the parts that you include? Because he is so aware of the significance of who he is in the eyes of the state.
That's right. Yes.
Once he becomes incarcerated.
Yes.
Right? He says, "We who are in prison had to answer for our sins, and our lives were taken from us. Our bodies became the property of the state of California. We are reduced to numbers and stripped of our identity. To the state of California, I am not Michael Alexander Allen, but I am K10033.
Yeah, You know, he was astute. He was smart. He could express the most complex emotions and give voice to experiences that are unimaginable for those of us who've never been inside a prison.
So what more did he... I mean, you were in contact with him constantly mm-hmm. during his incarceration, visits and phone. But what did his writing reveal to you that you think you might have otherwise not known about what being in prison did to him?
Well, could I read a little bit
yes.
more? Would that be okay?
Please.
That's probably the easiest way of doing
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
So let me just go ahead and read a little bit from his essay about Dante's Inferno. My hell is no longer demonstrating what I am capable of doing in order to survive. It has become what I can tolerate and withstand in order to live. I cannot help but to judge those around me. I am one of them, but we are far from the same. Like Dante, I am cursed with a spirit of discernment, which allows us to see the truth for what it is. There are most whom I despise who are truly sick beyond healing, and they should never leave this place. Then there are those who await to fulfill their destiny. I see in them a sincere and apologetic heart for their ill misdeeds. They are the ones who will change the world positively, or positively change someone's world. Hell cannot hold the latter of the two opposites, but in time will only spit them back out into society to do what is right. The hell that I live in cannot hold Dante. Hell can test and try oneself, but it cannot hold Dante, and it will not hold me. In the inferno, the dead are trapped forever. Surely the biggest and most important difference in the inferno and my hell called prison is that I have a way out.
It's amazing.
You know, he was a really special guy. No question about it.
Gosh, there's so much I want to talk to you about. Because part of he was writing a lot because of his natural talent, but also because he was working towards a college degree, mm-hmm. even though, again, at this time, most prisons, definitely the one he was in California, weren't right. offering any educational programs beyond a GED.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, this was a period where the whole criminal justice system had shifted gears from an approach to rehabilitation, trying to get people ready to reenter society, to a pure deterrent framework. Deterrence is really about focusing on sort of an aggregate level of crime, bringing it down, losing sight of the individual. And the use of mandatory minimum punishments, for example, is a very good expression of that deterrent philosophy. But because of this focus on deterrence, the goal was to make prison as bad an experience as possible, which I think, you know, basically people have really succeeded at doing. Whether achieving deterrence is a different question. But at any rate, so educational offerings were stripped out of prisons in the 1990s, and both states and federal government withdrew funding to support mm-hmm. prisoner education. But Michael was hungry for college. He had always been hungry for college. And so we got him enrolled in correspondence courses through Indiana University.
Yeah. You know, I keep going back to the fact that when he first became incarcerated, he was so young.
Yeah.
Right? He was 15.
Right.
And you write about how, you know, for most teenagers, there are a series of milestones mm-hmm. in your teenage years,
exactly.
you know, in the outside world. But
right.
there's an entirely different set of milestones that you suffer through
right, exactly.
in prison as a teenager.
Yeah.
And he went through all of them.
First long-term family separation.
Yeah.
So when he was 17, he was moved from the juvenile into the adult system, and he was moved to a prison at the Oregon border, which is crazy. I mean, it was so far away, his mother couldn't visit him. He spent his first 6 months in adult prison without a single family visit. And, you know, other rituals are, you know, first administrative segregation, as it's called, which is a label for solitary confinement, first racial melee, first sodomization. When I was writing the book, one of the things that was very important to do was to try to juxtapose different teenage experiences, and in particular mine and my cousins, and to show the things that are similar about them, the loneliness, the insecurity, the first experiments with intimacy and relationships and things like that, the effort to carve out your own space, the desire for mobility and freedom and so forth. And then just to show how, you know, this is a teenager going through all those experiences of an ordinary teenager, but in this cauldron of prison that is so violent and so full of brutality. And to then ask the question of, well, what does that mean? What kind of development can we expect for a young person in that sort of situation? It's just crazy to think.
So right after that chapter where it's Michael's essay, there are two, I think, quite amazing chapters. And they're all about you, really.
Yeah.
And can we talk about that for a minute? Because again, like you said, you're part of what you're doing here, what you want to talk about in this book is a strong juxtaposition. And I would also say constant reminder of how incarceration reverberates through a whole family.
Right.
And these two chapters are two different takes on how you felt or what you saw when you visited Michael
in
prison.
Right, yes.
So tell
us
about the first chapter.
Sure. So maybe I'll just read you a paragraph of it to give you sort of a flavor, some of the flavor of it.
And this chapter is called Visiting 1.0.
Visiting 1.0, exactly. Yeah. As Michael, known to the system as K10033, wrote, inmates went by numbers, not names. And visiting days were allocated to sets of numbers. Half of the evens on one Saturday, half of the odds on Sunday, the other halves of each set the following week. At 7:30 a.m., the guards would let a parade of Kias and Hyundais, Chevys and Dodges into the parking lot, and then you would sign in at a lectern at the front of a canopied structure with wooden benches that looked something like a tent revival meeting. Hosts of mainly black and brown women, but white women too, and many children, and some men, flitted in the shadows under the canopy. We could take in up to $30 in quarters or singles in plastic baggies, and we always took the maximum. The point of this was to purchase treats for the inmates from the row of vending machines, dispensing, as it turned out, quite disgusting microwavable cheeseburgers and burritos, along with mystery meat plates. So that's, I had sort of written a chapter about visiting that tried to go into the detail of the place, the people who were there, the things you saw, the things you smelled, and so forth. But if you listen to that, I'm talking about, you see this, you see that, you do that. And my editor, you know, every time I'd send the manuscript in, and mostly he was sort of doing line editing, but the one structural thing he would say is he kept coming back and saying, you're not in this chapter, Danielle, you're not in this chapter. And I didn't know what he meant. I was like, but I'm describing everything I saw, you know, this detail, that detail, and so forth. And finally, I realized what he meant, which is that up in the book, and that up until that point, I had been using I.
Uh-huh.
I had been saying, I felt, I did X. And suddenly in this chapter, I switched to you. And that was like this huge light bulb going off that even at this point, you know, many drafts into working on the book, I had not been able to break through a certain kind of repression to say, I was in prison. And here's what it was like for me. So I went back and wrote that chapter, you know, for my editor because he, you know, told me to.
And so you wrote it. You wrote it again.
I wrote it again. So then we have Visiting 2.0. So I can read a little bit of that. I will have to try again to describe what visiting Michael meant to me. The fact that I told the story as an academic already tells you everything you need to know. That wound of visiting Michael in prison goes so deep that somehow, even in writing this book, I have found it hard to own up to one simple fact. I went to prison. I was in prison. No, I don't mean that I have been arrested or convicted of a crime. I have avoided that because thus far in life, I have had that combination of goods that the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle thought was necessary for a happy life. Resources, decent character, and luck. But no, I was not in prison as a convict, and this is thanks to my father, my mother, and my God. Yet even as someone who could come and go, I felt the prison's mark, its branding fork. I felt it in my soul, even though all I was there was a day's sojourner.
You okay?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Forgive me for saying this, but that duality that we see in the first and second chapter there. I've even seen it here just
right
in our conversation.
I'm not surprised.
I mean, I can see that there are times when we're talking about sort of the policy implications of of criminal justice that you have a bold confidence. But when we get close to talking about really the impact that this has had on you and and Michael, it's hard.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean, you know, the whole point of being an academic is that you don't do this kind of thing. But so I'm grateful to Michael, because one of the things I've learned from doing this is just how important it is. Sorry. Even as an academic, to put head and heart together. So, for instance, I really, you know, these questions of criminal justice are questions that you can approach from an academic perspective. But knowing why they're important to approach and believing in one's heart as a motivation for research questions, for, you know, why do you choose particular research questions, that's super important. But it's fine to unify head and heart, even in the academy. And I think I've learned that thanks to Michael. And that's also something I'm trying to share.
Yeah. Oh. You know, when you talked about in the second chapter, the first person effect of you visiting Michael in prison and how you felt your soul get branded.
Yeah.
And that's just from being a visitor.
Yep. Just from a single day. Or, you know, I went a lot more than that, but even with a single day already, you feel that way.
And of course, Michael spent years in prison. So I come back to how he ended that essay on Dante about him. Excuse me. About him saying he has a way out.
Right.
Because it seems like ultimately, even though he did get out of prison, he didn't really have
he
a way
didn't.
Out.
No, exactly. Yeah, he didn't. No, his life changed inexorably that day when he was 15 and he tried to take somebody's car with a gun, inexorably and irreversibly. But that's what you realize is when somebody's been in prison for 11 years... and that's their social world and life. To ask them to start fresh is to ask them to give up every meaningful connection that has made their life bearable for the last 11 years. And that is a demand of surpassing difficulty.
But one of the things that happened to Michael, as you tell his story, is that, you know, as a young person, he's in prison during a time where, you know, the criminal justice system is incredibly punitive. A prison experience basically seeks to eradicate the humanity out of those people who've been incarcerated. But he falls in love,
too. He falls in love,
this incredibly human thing.
That's right, exactly.
And I can only begin to imagine the edges of the potency of that.
Right,
that in
exactly.
this place... that's so devoid of humanity,
yeah.
there's this profound connection. And he takes that connection with him.
That's right, exactly. It's the connection that he can't renounce.
Yeah.
And that means he was deeply and permanently connected to a person he loved and who loved him, but who was also violent. And their relationship had violence in it, and it ended in his death.
And yeah, because it had unspeakable consequences afterwards.
Exactly.
And that is what dogged him, even though... to a certain degree, the support system that he had through you
right.
and your family
right.
after he got out of prison was highly unusual.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, he had this big family. It had people with financial resources, people with educational resources in it. You know, we had a lot of things to bring to bear on trying to help Michael. And really, you know, remarkably, within 6 weeks of his release in 2006, we had... he was enrolled in school. He had a job and he'd been offered an apartment to live in. That was.
Can I just jump in here? I'm going to ask you to use I again, because you were a major part of this.
We did it together.
You know,
we were a team, the two of us. So, it was. Sorry. It's much easier not to use I. So, yes, I was with Michael's mother on his release day. And that was the beginning of summer of intense effort as we worked together to try to give him a foundation from which he could build something meaningful and valuable to him. He'd fought wildfires in California in prison, and he loved it. you know, that was, again, a sort of this bright spot, an opportunity for resilience and growth and something positive in the midst of the prison experience. And so he was going to work at Sears and be go to a community college that would let him do a fire technology program. And he and I were spending every day together putting these pieces together.
I don't mean to dig deep in a way that causes pain. I really don't. But I think it's really important for people to hear some of these details. I really do. Because that's, if we don't know,
right,
what's going to change? Nothing.
Right.
Because you write so beautifully about what seem to be small details, but they're so vitally important in the process that, again, Michael and you,
right,
and the family tried to go through to get him back on his feet.
Right.
And that moment that you write about where you find the place,
mm-hmm,
that looks like it's a perfect place for him to live.
Right.
And you had to go and introduce yourself to,
right,
to the landlords.
Yep. I went first.
Yeah.
I went first.
But even more important, I thought, as a reader reading the story, was there's a line where you say, then Michael went and you had practice with him on how to tell his story.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
To the landlords.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, who wants to rent an apartment to somebody who's just gotten out of prison after 11 years for attempted carjacking? I mean, that's a pretty big ask. So you can't kind of like just go into that without a lot of care and effort and so forth. So you have to find a good place and you have to be clear in your own mind. We had to be clear. I had to be clear. Michael had to be clear that it was right, that we could do right by the people who were there, that he could live well, that he could be in control of his life, that I could vouch for that. And so, yeah, it takes a lot of preparation to feel like ready to walk up to strangers and say, I can vouch for my cousin who's just been in prison for 11 years. Mm-hmm. And again, I say in the book, the two women who were there talking with us, they trusted us, and I will be eternally grateful for that act of generosity.
You and your family put so much effort into trying to rebuild his life. But his story is one where he could not get past the wounds and the consequences,
right,
of those wounds that he suffered while in prison. And he got killed.
Yeah, no, that's right. Well, it's just, you know, at the time when he was thinking about whether to take this apartment, I could not understand his thinking, his choice. I could not see I had no idea what was going on. I could make no sense of it at all. All I knew was, you know, at the end of 24 hours, he had decided firmly that he wasn't going to take the apartment. And then it wasn't until four or five months later when he called and said he was ready to take an apartment. And I went to go look at it with him. And he said that he and his girlfriend, Bree, were going to move into the apartment. Bree was his girlfriend whom he'd met in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So a transgender woman. They'd been lovers in prison, and I did not know that they were still seeing each other. They had reconnected after he got out. And I suddenly understood that that was what his decision-making was about that day when he couldn't take that apartment. It was a choice right then between Bree's world and the world he had for the last 11 years, and the world of his family, which he'd had too, but over the telephone, not day-to-day in terms of who he was living with, and the prospect of a future of great uncertainty and without yet having any concrete definition. And with that choice in front of him, he chose the love of his life.
Yeah. The love of his life, the one person who gave him physical comfort and love in prison when he was just a teenager. But it was Bree who pulled him back into gangs and to running drugs. And Danielle, it was Bree, the love of his life, who shot and killed Michael in 2009.
That's right, exactly. Yeah.
What is the lesson from Michael's life for all of us?
You know, I've been trying to boil it down to just one lesson, and I just find it impossible to do. So I think, you know, I have a couple, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So one lesson is just that when kids are 10 to 14, they need every adult in their life to be talking to each other. Like, forget about shame. Forget about the conflicts that keep different family members from sharing things with each other. Every kid in that hard adolescent transition period needs just like total openness and frankness from adults with them, making it possible for them to be open and frank also. And my family, we didn't do that. And that's, I think, our responsibility in this story. And then another lesson is that we have really destroyed lives with the criminal justice system. And that's a combination of how we think about juvenile justice, how we think about mandatory minimums, and what we've done with the war on drugs, which is to build this incredible world of hypocrisy and sustain an incredibly powerful, illegal black market. And we really underestimate its power and the general distorting effects it has on society and especially on youth experience. So I would put all these things together. And the last thing really about the question of, you know, Michael, what's Michael's responsibility? How do we think about that and so forth? I think Michael himself took responsibility for his choices, and his Dante essay makes that very clear. He understood he'd made the wrong choices, and he understood himself to have been motivated by, in his words, greed and lust in the moment when he tried to steal the car. And he knew that, and he changed, and he had a view about what was wrong with his own decision making. But at the same time that he accepted personal responsibility for his own choices, I think as a society, we also have to accept responsibility for the fact that we present young people with vastly disparate degrees of difficulty on the life courses in front of them. And yes, even in the most difficult circumstances, some people can master the degree of difficulty and overcome, but many people can't. And when society is leaving young people in poverty, leaving young people without access to good education, we have to recognize that we are creating the patterns, the degrees of difficulty that they're obliged to confront. Yeah.
The New Yorker excerpted part of your book, and in the subtitle of in the New Yorker excerpt, it's "A crime committed at 15 derailed my cousin's life. Why couldn't I save him?" Is that a question that you ask yourself?
This book was driven by why questions.
Yeah.
You know, it's called "Cuz," which means cousin, but it also means because. And yes, I had been tormenting myself with why questions. And they weren't so much why couldn't I save him, although there was a sort of why did the process of trying to help him go wrong? You know, like, why didn't it work? Why did he end up dead with such promise and so many people who loved him? And for me, the most important why question, why did he end up on that street corner holding a gun, trying to take somebody's car? Again, given he had this extended family that loved him, was committed to him, had resources and so forth. So the book is just a really sort of intense effort to answer those kinds of why questions.
Yeah. And another why question that you ask is, why can't we do better?
Yeah. Why can't we do better for our kids?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Can we do better? Now, you implore us as a society at the end.
I know we can, because everybody knows at this point the sort of stunning facts about incarceration in America, that we have 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's incarcerated population, and 2 million people in prisons. And I think I just want to implore people to realize that when you've got 2 million people in prison, every single one of those people is connected to, you know, you name it, 20 other people, 40 other people, 50 other people, something. But so every single person in prison represents a huge impact on our society, you know, more on the order of 20 to 60 million people being impacted in any given year on account of this. And the ripple effects of this are just tremendous. And I think we really have to come confront the kind of damage that we've done to our own society with this approach to criminal justice.
Absolutely. Can I ask you one last thing?
Sure.
I know you carry Michael in your heart with you every day.
Yep.
But how has writing this book, what has it done for you?
Well, I answered my questions. So I have a certain kind of peace that comes from not, you know, constantly, you know, beating yourself with these questions. So yes, I'm deeply grateful for that. I'm deeply grateful to my aunt for having given me permission to do this, that, you know, I had to start by asking her if I could do this. And I do have my answers now.
Well, the book is "Cuz, The Life and Times of Michael A. It's by Danielle Allen. She's a professor at Harvard University. And I think it's one of the most important books written in the past 5 years, and it has been an absolute privilege to talk with you about it, Danielle.
Thank you very much for having me, and I truly appreciate your taking this time to spend with Michael's story. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have an excerpt of Danielle's book on our website. Please do read it. It's at radioboston.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.